Blog Talk Radio.
How you been doing?
Doing good. How about yourself?
I've been doing well. A little busy, but doing really well. It's always good to be
good.
You got Z on
good.
With us tonight?
Yes, I'm happy and here with us.
Hey, I'm happy to be here. How are you guys doing?
Doing great. Hey, can we start the show on a light note and get a medical update?
He's been doing well.
Good.
Progressing. And slowly but surely regaining his strength.
Nice.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just so everybody I know, we're talking about a guy who in, I'm trying to think back, in 1976, personally took on a debt and worked through that debt to keep a school open. And we'll hear something from Dr. Carol. I'll be calling in a little later on in the show. And she has wants to talk about St. Peter's Cathedral. And they seem to be in the same dire straits that they were at one point. So she'll explain.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, we're talking about the father of my two partners here, Mr. Mel Parquet. Parquet. I got it right the first time. Don't say parquet, say butter. But
what it is he had it wrong all those years. That's what happened. That's what we found out. He had it wrong all those years.
$150,000 is Parquet, and over $50,000 a year it's Parquet.
Yeah, well then we're all Parquet.
Hey, Ty, one of your guys is coming back in July 13th. Oh, gosh, January 13th, Esteban de Lara is coming back in the ring, huh?
Yeah, yeah, he's fighting, and I do like Esteban de Lara. I personally think he's the best junior middleweight, but, you know, it's debatable, it's arguable. But he's coming back against Yuri Foreman. And Esteban de Lara himself is not necessarily satisfied with his opponent. He himself said, I'm looking for bigger fights, but, you know, this is – he's going to be hungry. He wants to take my title, and this is what I have to do now, but I'm looking for much bigger fights.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What are you thinking of
he fought Vandis Metalurgian twice, and that's – I mean, that to me shouldn't have really happened. But that's right now the caliber that Laura is getting, and it's through no fault of his own. It's just the style of fighter he is and the difficulty in facing him. And it's, you know, you're fighting a guy who can hit you and you're not able to really lay a glove on it. That's frustrating. That's frustrating. Mm-hmm. And guys don't want, and that makes you look bad. And even if you win, you don't look good. And that, to a certain extent, will decrease your future earnings because people, you know, well, it's generally promoted. You know, I can't say what people want to say. That's up to each individual. But it's generally promoted that, you know, the action fighters, you want to see people, you know, banging out, hit and get hit, and, you know, the tough guy. You know, you want people gravitate, the promotions gravitate more toward that, to where Esteban de Lara's not. Well, neither is Yuri Foreman. So, I mean, that's...
But, you know, the thing, too, is, though, even with that, too, what I think makes this situation even tougher is there are really no more marquee fights for him around his weight division unless welterweights move up, unless you have a Kell Brook or a Keith Thurman move up. Part of it is he's already had his money fight with Canelo. So Canelo is not looking to necessarily cross that bridge again, and you can't blame him. The other thing is the other champions, the Charlo brothers, are his stablemates. You know, they're like brothers, so he's not going to fight those two. The only other fight out there at that weight for him right now would be Demetrius Andrade, but he's been having a hard time staying as active as some of the other fighters, so it'd be interesting to see what he does. But at this point, unless you take a Keith Thurman or, you know, a Kell Brook or an Amir Khan, one of these guys moving up, then there's not necessarily a big fight for Lara. But the problem is when people invade his weight division, say Cotto, then Lara is definitely not the first guy you want to fight. He's a hard style matchup, like Zito said, and he doesn't bring much money to the table. So guys like that, like Lara, like Guillermo de Rigondeaux, it's hard for those guys sometimes to get their career going because they're too good for their own good, but they don't aesthetically please a lot of the fans and a lot of the writers who aren't as objective as they claim to be.
Yeah, and you have a point with he's essentially he's fought Canelo, he's fought Angulo. I mean, he's basically fought who else? He's fought Trout.
He's fought Paul Williams. He's fought Trout.
Paul Williams.
I mean, he fought
mainly the big names. I mean, the bigger names that at the time, and really, you know, sort of now that, you know, was up there. So,
yeah, so he fought some of the marquee fighters in his division.
Yeah.
But the marquee fighters in his division now he's aligned with. So those are fights that aren't going to happen. The other big guy is Canelo. So obviously you'd have to have Heyman and Golden Boy do business, which just very well may not happen. Even if that does happen, that's not a fight Canelo is looking to take. Canelo right now is talking about fighting Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. at 165.
Exactly.
They started talks for that. So
Heyman advised fighter.
Yeah, so a guy like Lara is kind of frozen out of the big fights. Thus, he has to fight a Yuri Foreman to stay busy.
Yeah, or else he'll have to essentially move up and try to take fights at heavier
weight. At 160.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I was going to say, speaking of which, Ty, he brought up the fight between Canelo and Julio Cesar Chavez Jr., which they were in serious negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
So,
on the other side of that, a fight that was in serious negotiations that's now signed, believe it or not, is Triple G against Danny Jacobs. That fight has been signed, apparently.
Oh, wow.
And I think it will be March 18th at
Madison
Square Garden.
Yes, sir.
So,
nice.
Yeah, so that will be, somewhat of a big fight. They're looking at HBO pay-per-view for that. I personally don't think it's a pay-per-view worthy fight, but it should be a bigger test in some ways than Lemieux, so I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah, I saw a picture of them together. I guess they were at maybe a after party press conference, something like that. But they Danny Jacobs had a suit on, and
Triple G had a
Triple
T-shirt
G had
on,
a button,
had the button,
he had
the
a button
shirt.
There.
Yeah,
he had a button, a nice button down going
yep,
up shirt.
I saw that picture too.
Yeah, and they relatively didn't look different in size.
Nah,
yeah.
It didn't look like Kell Brook in a suit next to Triple G. Kell Brook was muscular. Now, Kell Brook looked great. He looked fantastic. He looked like he was cut of stone. However, Kell Brook in a three-piece suit, you look like you could take him and stuff him in Gennady Golovkin's T-shirt, and there'd still be room for him to swim. Like, that's how much bigger and denser Gennady looked. When I looked at Jacobs next to him, I was like, okay. You know, I don't think Jacobs can – I don't predict Jacobs to win. I don't need to watch significant footage to tell you why I don't predict Jacobs to win. But from a physicality standpoint, he can match him. He has the size and the power and the speed to cause Golovkin some problems. I just don't know if he's good enough, honestly.
I think he's good enough in spots. I just think the other spots is his arm.
I don't think he's good enough.
It's hard to go into a fight against Gennady Golovkin and your armor is the question mark. I mean, not saying
Danny Jacobs
something wrong with it, but it's the
question.
He's only
28 years old. You know, we kind of forget how young, 28 to 29. So you kind of forget how young Danny is because he's been on the scene for a while. He's battled cancer, come back from that. He's been through a lot in a short amount of time. But I do think that Daniel Jacobs is kind of the finished product. He is who he's going to be. And I think he has the potential at times to be a dynamic offensive fighter.
Yeah.
Just like most fighters, he has some holes in his defense. And, you know, styles make fights, and you know, there are reasons why someone would think he could really cause Golovkin trouble. But regardless of what transpires during the bout, there's no doubt, it's 100% certainty in my mind how that fight is going to finish, though. So,
and it's a certainty in my mind the fight's taking place based off of Gennady Golovkin's performance against Kell Brook. It was a dominating performance, don't get it twisted, but you know, Kell Brook was able to hit him with pretty good shots and spots that seemed to slow Golovkin down, I would like to say.
In my mind, I think the fight's taking place based on Danny Jacobs getting a career-high payday. That's
he lobbied for that for a while. In football terms, he held out for that for a while.
You can't blame him.
For a fight of this magnitude and against a guy that could potentially hurt you going forward in your career,
Now, you know what? Here's kind of the antithetical argument to that. So, Jacobs, the reason why the negotiations took so long is because Golovkin brings more to the table, brings, you know, more name recognition to the table, yada, 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 yada. Jacobs is supposed to take the low end of the money. The purse bid obviously would have left Jacobs with 25%. The big thing Jacobs wanted was at least 40%.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were jumping on Jacobs, saying Jacobs is ducking Golovkin, yada, 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 yada. However, when the situations are reversed and Canelo is offering Gennady Golovkin the short end of the money, and Gennady doesn't take it, well, people say, well, you know, Canelo's ducking Gennady. So, you know, to me, it's just funny, the bias of the fans. When, you know, a lot of times, one thing I've learned about negotiations and contracts is usually there's so many little things in there that hold up the deal that it's rarely as simple as money. And, you know, it's funny that fans and writers jump to defend one person in one situation but not another person in that same exact situation, when a little objectivity will allow, you know, the truth to ring free sometimes.
And the media plays a part in that. The media
That's why I said some writers, too. That's specifically why I said some writers.
Because, I mean, boxing, it has so little outlets. I mean, they have a lot of outlets, but so many little mainstream outlets that the news that gets pumped out, you know, people, you know, the general public tend to hold as gold. And that's, you know, all the time, that's not, well, many of the time, that's not the actual facts or the reality.
Yeah, you know, one of the thing is it's very rare that the boxers are actually physically scared of each other. I mean, it happens. But it's usually not the case. Usually what the case is that their business people around them are telling them this is not the best business decision for you. And with boxers not being taken care of, in a sense, they have to take care of themselves. They're individual contractors. They don't work for anybody.
Exactly.
They also have to maximize what they can monetize during the course of their career, which usually is over by the time they're 34, 35, 36. You know what I mean? So it's a short window to monetize. And so when you get in the position, I can see why some guys say, you know what, I don't want to damage my brand in this particular way. So, you know, again, I don't like the business of boxing, but I understand business, which makes me understand the business of boxing.
And that's why you can't blame Danny Jacobs for holding out.
I cannot.
When you deal with quarterbacks who hold out, and they, you know, they have a right to. They say, well, I feel I'm worth this much money. When it comes down to it, I do take this much amount of damage, but I advance the team this much. Well,
right.
That's the same respect for a boxer, or should have, and even to more of a degree. I mean, every single
You know,
fight,
especially, Zito, a sport where you're putting your health on the line. You
every
know, you mentioned football, and that's what I kind of equated it to in a sense, because football, boxing, you literally put your health on the line. And boxing, part of the goal is to render your opponent unconscious.
Exactly, to take health away.
Exactly.
To maintain as much of your health as you can and to take the opponent's health away. That is the
objective.
When you
play
the
video games,
that's the touchdown, that's the dunk.
When you play the video games, you get 2 meters. One of the meters is for your power, the other is for your health.
That's right.
So,
it's funny you talk about that, Ty, because Povetkin did exactly that this afternoon.
Oh, this guy.
His meter.
Yeah, his meter.
Yeah, he knocked out Dufas.
Oh, I thought that was Dr. Chris for a minute. Dufas.
No. He's not gonna be on for another 15 minutes. He's still in the golf shop.
Yeah, you sound like him calling Duhapis Dufas though. Dr. Chris kind of line there. Johann Duhapis, who literally took the flight, who literally took the fight in like 20 minutes notice. All right,
yeah,
so,
I hope they didn't test him.
Yesterday the guys on a golf course, you know, thinking about what he's picking up for Christmas. Today he's in a fight, so he lasted 6 rounds. I think that's good considering he woke up thinking he was playing tennis, and next thing you know, he's boxing. The real story is Povetkin failed yet another drug test. Bermaine Stavervin said, this is unprofessional. I'm going back to America. WBC pulled the fight. The WBC didn't sanction the fight, which is what caused Bermaine to leave. Bermaine didn't leave until he got the decision that the WBC was no longer sanctioning it as a title eliminator. He said, my goal is to win back the title. It makes no sense for me to fight. He says, I hope that the WBC will go ahead and make me the mandatory challenger to Deontay Wilder. But the issue is with Povetkin failing this drug test again, second time this year, it's not a good look. Not a good look. And then, you know, what you got to remember, too, is there's been a lot of strange things going on in Russia with fighters saying, you know, their food's contaminated. But, you know, with the whole revelation of the state-sponsored doping program, it just really shines a bad light on anything of that nature coming out of Russia. I don't know if you guys read this today, too. Jurriorkis Gamboa was supposed to fight former South African, former world champion from South Africa, Malcolm Clawson. You guys remember Malcolm Clawson?
Yes.
That fight got called off today because apparently Malcolm Clawson's hotel was raided, and they found a bunch of steroids in there. And so now they're being charged with some kind of drug push and possession crime. So, you know, right now it just looks like steroids is literally really running rampant in boxing. But, yeah, what happened with Povetkin, Malcolm Clawson, it's not a good look. And it doesn't bode well for the sport. And I think you're going to see more stringent testing and more significant penalties as well.
And I hear the arguments about competitive edge in sports and everything. It's one thing when you're dealing with a ball, not as much football either, but when you're dealing with basketball or baseball, when the object that you're dealing with is harmless. Then that's on your own body. You have to take care of yourself. But it's another thing when you're going in and you're physically dealing with another person. Now, that's damaging. And I think the rules should be more stringent, point blank. People could say, I don't know what I'm putting in my body. You know, it's you know, the food may be contaminated. It's a point of fact that within a sport like boxing, if you don't check it stringently like that, then somebody's going to get hurt seriously behind that. People probably have, and we may not know about it. So I think the regulations should be a lot stronger.
You know, Ty, you were talking about, you brought up Deontay Wilder. The WBO, rather, is trying to do a unification fight in 17 with he and Joseph Parker. How do you think that would work?
Well, that would work well for Joseph Parker, but I don't think that's something that's going to happen anytime soon. Mm-hmm. First of all, Deontay has to heal from his injury. His last defense was a voluntary defense against Chris Areola, so more than likely he's going to have to go ahead and take care of his mandatory defense, which, again, could be very well be Berman Stiverne because of what happened to Povetkin today. So specifically because of what happened today, some of the aftermath, some of the fallout from that is you don't necessarily know what direction the WBC is going to mandate that Deontay Wilder take. Obviously, they would probably allow for a unification fight with Joseph Parker, but Joseph Parker just won that title. He just scraped by against Andy Ruiz. I do see Joseph Parker, you know, he's young, 24, I believe, staying in New Zealand, developing his craft, having some easy defenses, kind of like they were doing with Anthony Joshua up until this Klitschko fight. You know what I mean? Keeping him in London and having some, you know, some defenses that allowed him to grow as a fighter. Nothing too tough. Some, I don't want to say easy touches, but winnable fights, I should say. I see the same thing being done with Parker and grooming him until they get him to a point where they think he would stand a better chance at a big money fight. And I don't see them rolling the dice with Deontay Wilder at this particular point.
I hope not. I hope Parker's not a victim of being brought up too soon. Like many young boxers who look good early against certain competition. The Andrew Ruiz fight told me, and I think his handlers, that he wasn't ready. And that's a good thing. I mean, he won the fight, supposedly. I didn't really get to see all of it. But from what I heard, it could have went either way. He has growing to do. And Deontay Wilder at this point in time is top notch. You do not want to see top notch when you are not anywhere near that level. When you're toe to toe with Andy Ruiz, and you're struggling on that level, well then you don't need to see Keontae Wilde.
And you know what? And it's funny because both Andy Ruiz and Joseph Parker, you know, and you know, all things being honest in a sport, we have one champion, Joseph Ruiz and Andy Parker. Or Joseph Parker and Andy Ruiz, what they would actually be are fringe contenders, but they would be prospects that you could say, hey, these guys, you know, may be able to make some waves in the division a little later on. But just because we have these split belts is the reason why, you know, an Andy Ruiz and a Joseph Parker could contend for a title at this point in their careers. They were essentially their first big step up. I give Joseph Parker credit for fighting Carlos Takam. Andy Ruiz hadn't fought anybody of note to that point in his career. So it was his first really big step up. So, you know, neither guy should be in a true world championship picture, but again, due to the split belt nature of the sport, that's allowed to happen. Even Anthony Joshua at this point should probably more than likely be like a top three, top four contender as opposed to a title holder. Same thing with Deontay Wilder. But the fact of the matter is we have split titles, and at this point in time, there's definitely a gulf between the top, you know, three or four fighters and you know, everyone else beneath them. And Joseph Parker, Andrew Ruiz, they're good fighters. They could be a lot better in the future, but right now, like Zito said, they don't compare with that upper echelon. The upper echelon, essentially, you know, is a healthy Tyson Fury, Vladimir Klitschko, Joshua Wilder, and, you know, I would have to consider David Haye up there, too. And, you know, those guys aren't ready for that level at this point.
I'm going to be honest. I obviously have to see if Anthony Joshua is up to that level. Me personally, I'm not going to just toss him in with Klitschko yet, just because the fight really, to me, hinges on is Klitschko too old or is Joshua too young? I mean,
you know what? It's funny. I think you know, we talked about it. I always thought it was a little too early. But I know Joshua is more developed than Joseph Parker and Andy Ruiz at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So he's in that upper echelon. He's in that upper tier. Where he fits in that upper tier, don't know. He could be the very last one in that upper tier. But he's closer to that upper tier. Whereas, like, you know, Andy, like, you know, a good fight, good fights for Joseph Parker right now, you know, would be a, you know, Chris Areola, you know, fights he could learn and develop against with somebody who could push him. He's better than that. He has quick hands, but he doesn't move his head much.
No.
And there's not too many shots that are thrown that he doesn't try to meet with his face.
He doesn't move his feet too.
Nah. You know, but I tell you what was kind of fun watching is Andy Ruiz throws some really quick, crisp combinations. And between Joseph Parker and Andy Ruiz, those are two of the faster-handed heavyweight fighters you'll see.
Yeah.
And I give you this, man, if these guys really, you know, learn their craft, for Andy Ruiz, it's more about conditioning, then, you know, they're capable with their hand speed and their, you know, combination punching, they're capable of giving anybody, you know, a hard night's work at least.
Depending how they develop.
They have to develop.
Just because, yeah, just they can't get there, then it's going to be problems. I don't know if Parker wants to see Areola just yet. I still think Areola, he's over the bush, but he still has to push him. I mean, you still have to do things to him.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that. I think it'd be a tough fight. But one thing I've liked about Parker is he's shown me he knows how to win. And he's shown me he knows how to adjust. I've seen him have to do that in the Carlos Takam fight and figure out a way to win. And, you know, I think between the two, I think Andrew Ruiz is the better, more fluid boxer. But I think Parker being a little younger and with his physicality, Parker has a better upside. I just personally, I think Parker's going to always be limited. I really do. But I could see why people would be high on him because he does have a good upside.
Yeah.
What do you guys think about Sullivan Barrera?
I watched that fight last night, man. I tell you what, he wasn't necessarily favored against Shabransky. Shabransky had beat Unieski Gonzalez, who really should have gotten a victory over Jean Pascal. So, in fact, Shevransky was one of the guys that, and I know I'm saying his last name wrong, but he was one of the guys that when Andre Ward came back, it was specifically stated that, oh, I bet you Andre Ward won't fight him. You know what I mean? And Sullivan Barrera, coming off a fight against Andre Ward where he didn't look good at all. You know, a lot of people, you know, talk that, oh, Andre Ward looked rusty. And that was the conversation coming out of the fight, right? See how bad and how rusty and out of step Andre Ward looked. But what people kind of forgot is he made Sullivan Barrera look like an amateur. And Sullivan Barrera was a decorated amateur. He made him look like just an amateur.
Decorated professional.
So you know, to see Sullivan Barrera take care of business the way he did last night, one thing it made me say is, man, Sullivan Barrera is 34, but he's a young 34, like a lot of these Cubans, because he got a late start in his pros. He doesn't have a lot of wear and tear on him. But it also made me say, man, damn, Andre Ward is really good, because Sullivan Barrera couldn't get going at all against Andre Ward, whereas he dropped Shevransky in the first round. And you know, from that point on, you know, they traded knockdowns in the second round, or, you know, kind of in the second round, he got knocked down, but he just took control of the fight, and he looked dynamic offensively. So, you know, he has some fights ahead of him. It'd be interesting to see what he could do. Could he beat Beterbiev? Could he beat a Kovalev? I don't know about that. But this was a big, big win for him at this stage in his career. Big win. And he's a Kathy Duva guy, too, so kudos to Kathy Duva.
Yep. Well, one thing is, I remember, and you did too, I think, Ty, we watched a couple of Sullivan Barrera fights leading up to the Andre Ward fight.
Yeah. We also remember we saw Sullivan fight in Delaware. No, we saw him in Philly at the 2300.
Yes,
that's when I saw how, like, man, that guy's kind of big. You know, I mean, I remember that.
Long.
Yeah, I remember that. It looked like, his arms, it looked like he was bruising his knuckles from his arms scraping the ground. You know what I mean? He just looked like a physical specimen. You know, nice, solid, long, light heavyweight.
Yeah, and one thing is, watching those fights before the Ward fight, I mean, the guy could box. I mean, Sullivan, he can hit hard. He's a big guy. He's long arms, but he could box. He's not the fastest guy.
No, Sullivan isn't. He's not the best. You know, it's funny because he's built like, you know, he looks like a phenom, but, his aesthetic doesn't match his athleticism. You know, in spite of how dynamic he looks, he's nowhere near as athletic as he looks. You know what I mean? And that was really – huh?
Not for boxing.
You look at him, you think he's going to have this dynamic speed and this dynamic speed and dynamic power, and he's kind of not that way. And, you know, and it's funny because when he was fighting Andre Ward, you saw he didn't have the best coordination even. But he's a fluid boxer. And his problem is he tends to get hit more than he should. But the problem is he does that because he opens up. He throws in combinations and he steps in. He's not trying to avoid every shot. He's usually trying to lay something on you, which opens him up to getting hit. And that's a little different than the traditional Cuban styles that Americans are used to seeing in the pros.
Well, two things about Sullivan. His reactions aren't of Cuban nature. To be honest, most Cubans, you see, they have pretty good reactions, especially defense.
Yeah, his reflexes are kind of crazy out there.
Yeah, his reflexes, when punches are coming at him, aren't mm-hmm. really that sharp. And the second thing is his feet. His feet aren't exactly of the Cuban nature either. Sullivan is not, he doesn't turn corners. He doesn't do the side-to-side thing much. And a problem
he's
kind of
like
I
Nick
think,
Walters out there. He's kind of like Nick Walters out there.
Sort of, but not as clean. The thing with Sullivan is his feet betray him, and I think that he rocks on his back foot on that heel a lot.
So when
somebody's advancing, he really can't plant and turn. He has to totally set his foot structure up to really get any leverage on anything, or even turn to the opponent when they're going. That's why I think Andre Ward was able to stare him all night long. Ward had a problem at first, you know, and if any time with anything with Sullivan, with certain parts of Sullivan's time. And just because he has long arms and he has pretty
good
timing at times.
Yeah. Sullivan's feet are probably to be one of his worst assets because, like you said, his feet tend to be flat and squared up at times. That's how Ward knocked him down. And not only that, but, again, I hearken to how he looks like an Adonis, but his athleticism doesn't necessarily match the way he looks. He's just not fluid and light of foot in the ring at all. I think a part of it's technique, but just looking at it, I think also a part of it's just his greater lack of dynamic athleticism. He's obviously a good athlete, but again, he's not in the class of, you know, of Roy Jones. You know, he's closer to a Tavoris Cloud. You know what I mean? But he's just a more fluid boxer. And I think what happens when I watch Sullivan, I see a guy who's kind of caught between his style and his mentality. He's been trained so long to fight one way, but it seems like, you know, his mindset is I really want to let loose and throw punches. And so to me, sometimes when he steps in, he's not always defensively responsible. He's much more defensively responsible when he's stepping out, as most Cuban fighters are. It's when they tend to step in, they're a little bit more open because, you know, it seems to me most Cuban fighters aren't necessarily really trained to fight in the pocket. You know, they're trained to catch and shoot. Like Arislande Lara is a beautiful catch and shooter, but they're not necessarily trained to fight in the pocket, dig to the body, yada, 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 yada. And so Sullivan, who does some of these things, does it with a little bit more reckless abandon than he should be doing at this stage in this, you know, period.
And you're right, it's the training. Training is the key thing. Sullivan, his balance, I don't understand. His balance seems off a lot. Mm-hmm. But what I do like is he's a guy who fights within himself.
He
doesn't really try to be a Roy Jones or a Chad Dawson in the style or even a Andre Ward. He's simple. He's not real complicated in what he does, but he does it well. He fights sort of like a football player who's learned a bit more than most football players do in boxing than me. He's squared up, as you said, his feet are flat, and it looks like he's more or less almost wants to wrestle you at times. But, I mean, he'll look like he wants to wrestle you. You'll be squared up thinking he wants to wrestle you. They'll pop you with the jab.
You know where he looked good last night, man, was his timing with that right. Bringing that right over Szymanski's jab, you know what I mean? And he's got heavy hands, too. You know, he's got pretty heavy hands. He on a good night, Sullivan Barrera could give anybody, I think, hell in that division. I think there's certain guys that can make him look bad, though. You know what I mean? And against a bigger, I'm not going to say bigger, but against a big, strong guy like Kovalev, I don't know how Sullivan wins that fight, you know, at this particular point in time. I mean, he's capable of hitting them and hurting Kovalev, but just based on, you know, the two fighters and their styles, you know, I think there is a limit to what Sullivan can accomplish. But, I was really happy that he won that fight last night. I like Sullivan Barrera a lot, actually, so I was really excited that he won that fight.
I tell you, an interesting style I would like to see him against is in the Adonis Stevens, style-wise.
Too bad this week with
Abner Maris.
Bernard Hopkins. Oh, yeah. You know what? Jesus Cuellar, he's a professional fighter who's accomplished a lot. And, you know, I think it really can be stated he's accomplished a lot because he looks terrible as far as, I mean, his feet are horrible. He just really looked bad. You know what I mean? He just really looked bad. And Maris still had to work to outbox him just because of, you know, Cuellar's size and his, you know, somewhat relentlessness.
Right.
But he made it all too easy for Maris. He really did. He didn't do anything. He didn't cut off the ring. He squared up. I don't know what kind of. He was just throwing punches from all sorts of angles, but there was I was really, really disappointed with his performance. Guys who tend to fight with that type of reckless abandon tend to be fearless and relentless. You can't fight with that kind of reckless abandon in your technique and be methodical. Like, that's not going to work. You know what I mean? You can't fight like that and then give the guy time and space to find the holes which are gaping. You can't do that. And I mean, it was a pitiful performance by Cuellar. I heard him screaming he wanted a rematch, and I was just like, dude, you need to take like a good year and just work and just train and work on your technique, work on keeping your hands up, work on not walking over your own feet. I mean, geez. It was just one of the worst performances from a fundamental technical standpoint I had seen in a world-class fight in ages, seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to say that I first want to, you know, give Abner Maris credit, kudos. He had to work all night long, and he did the right work. He worked to the body, he worked to the head, he got his power shots in. He showed me that Cuellar was tough because Abner Maris, I mean, he's not Paulie Malignaggi in the fist, and he was getting some real good shots in on Cuellar. With Cuellar, I've never exactly seen a guy whose feet and hands didn't match up. I thought I was looking at two different boxes. I thought they had the split screen from the lower split screen to where you see the different feet moving and the upper body's not moving quite the same.
Yeah.
It looked like Cuellar looked like that all fight long.
Never seen anything like that in a fight in my life.
His feet were doing one thing, and his hands were all over the place.
It's funny.
Swimming.
He was stalking Abner Maris, and it looked like he was holding a hockey stick. I'm watching a fight literally thinking there's a hockey stick in this guy's hands. Like, how is he holding his hands? It looks like he's holding a hockey stick. You know, and then he was swinging like he was holding a hockey stick. It was it was just a very poor fundamental performance. Like, if I'm telling people to watch a fighter to learn, not Cuellar at all.
Never were his movements coordinated along with his body. He swam at Abner Maris a lot. Actual throwing punches in a swimming motion. He threw looping uppercuts at air. Abner Maris would turn him, and he would still throw the punch. Clearly, Abner Maris was out the way. He would actually throw the punch like he was still there. I don't know if he had nervous energy throughout the whole fight and just fought kind of panicky, but maybe he thought Abner Maris would stand right in the middle and trade with him, and that would be the fight, and he didn't think he would have to. Abner Maris had boxing skills, but
it's funny you say that, because I think, you know, when you think Abner Maris at his best, he likes that Danny Garcia range. You know what I mean? Where he's kind of in that mid-range where he could, you know, touch it to the head and face and then step in and, you know, tag it to the body, or at that mid-range where he could just kind of take that half step back to parry a couple shots. And maybe Cuellar wasn't prepared for him to use his feet the way he did, even though Abner had used his feet before. But it just seemed like Cuellar had no concept of how to close distance responsibly. None. I was really disappointed in his performance. Not that I thought if he, you know, performed any better per se, he would beat Maris, but he just did not look like a professional boxer in the ring at all.
He looked like he was trying to brawl with a fly.
Yeah, he looked like he had, you know, the world class stamina and durability of a professional fighter, but he didn't look like a professional boxer. He didn't conduct himself in the manner that boxers usually conduct themselves with how they throw punches, even aggressive fighters like Orlando Salida.
Even a good fighter. Because you have good fighters who know how to get there and stay there in their moments.
I honestly can't remember seeing a world-class fight where I was, like, so disgusted with the technique. You know, where I was just like, wow, this technique is atrocious.
And especially with guys that weigh that little, because usually when you weigh that weight, the everything's coming faster. Your technique has to be crisper. They're that much more crisp.
You know, the funny thing is everyone looks at Salido, for instance, and it says, well, he's a crude brawler. Salido is a master boxer. He's just a pressure fighter, but he's a master at picking off shots. You know, one of the things that was giving Lomachenko trouble, besides Salido stepping switching stances to close distance was the fact that Salido was fainting so much. And so Lomachenko was having a hard time finding his timing because Salido doesn't just step in. I mean, I didn't see any of that stuff from Cuellar. You know what I mean? It was just
no discipline.
No discipline. He literally fought like a bull in a china shop, literally.
Well, you know what they call good punchers who could get there.
There's another fight coming up that they're digging up a long-time fighter. What the hell is his first name? Lucien Bute in February is going to have a fight. And I'm not really sure who – do you guys know anything about this Storm Alvarez?
Yeah, I know exactly who he's fighting. He's fighting Elider Alvarez, you know, who was supposedly going to fight Adonis Stevenson. So I don't know why Alvarez is fighting Lucien Bute, but, you know, credit to Lucien Bute. When he does fight, he fights, you know, top-class opponents. Elider Alvarez is a top-10 light heavyweight. Good boxing skills. Somebody who definitely could cause Lucien Bute some problems, and he's probably favored to beat Bute. Bute is another one coming off a steroid suspension. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see what Bute has left. But in his last two performances at 168 against Badu Jack and against, who was the other guy, DeGale, he looked pretty good, especially towards the end of the fight. But moving up to 175 and taking on Elider Alvarez is something a little different. So, it'll be interesting.
See? Well, this should be good, harmless preparation for the Southpaw Adonis Stevenson. I mean, Bute's quicker. He's a little bit slicker. Adonis hits harder. They come at sort of different angles. Bute, he comes at more angles when he's not on the retreat, which you'll find if when the contact gets a bit hard, you'll find him a little bit more on the retreat trying to pot shot. One and done, trying to roll out. Bute, to me, he lost that fight to Badu Jack. I thought he pulled out the fight against the girl, but I thought he lost the fight to Badu Jack.
But both fights he was in. He lost both fights, but both fights he was right in, you know?
Yeah, and that's right when you think that Bute, you know, career-wise was kind of dipping down. He showed in those fights he still has it. Well, then
you know what the funny thing is, Zito? You know, here's the funny thing. Remember when Bute was this undefeated champion? You know, he had that one little scare in Montreal with Liberato Andrade, but he was like this undefeated champion, dynamic speed, power. Then he got kind of looked like essentially ruined by Carl Froch.
Yeah, he ran over
by Froch, comes back. He's saying he has a back injury or shoulder injury, and he loses that very uneventful fight to Pascal. And so it looks like his career is basically done. But to me, the Lucien Bute I've seen in these last two fights is a better all-around fighter than he ever was. He's not as quick. You know, he can't get there with that power as much, but he's a much slicker, craftier, more complete, well-rounded fighter than he ever was. What he was before was a sniper whose head was on kind of whose head was on a totem now. You know, he's a sniper who didn't move his head. But now, you see Liberato fighting in the pocket, or not Liberato, you see Bute fighting in the pocket, rolling off with a punch, coming back with an uppercut, he always had a nice little uppercut to the body, but he stands his ground better. He stands his ground better. He pushes forward better. He moves his head in there better. He catches punches off the gloves better. He's just become, you know, it's kind of like Bernard Hopkins, where as they were getting older, you know, tonight's Bernard's last fight, but as they were getting older, you could see them becoming significantly craftier. And, you know, not that, you know, Bute's aging as gracefully as B-Hop, because I don't know if you can in the sport, but Bute, who, you know, it's just funny to see him, now that his athleticism is somewhat diminished, doing things that he never used to do. It's just it's fun to watch at times.
Fighter fans tend to forget, Bute is an experienced fighter.
He's top-level
competition. He's beat Glenn Johnson, although older Glenn Johnson is still a dangerous Glenn Johnson. I mean, he's faced.
And you can't fight Glenn Johnson and not learn something, especially Glenn Johnson.
And that's why I actually think he started becoming better far as technical. Physically, that's different. Carl Froch and him didn't match up physically. Gene Pascal and him didn't match up physically. When you get aggressive fighters like that, who timid can walk through a punch and still want to fight, he has problems with. But what he has shown me is he's grown much more offensively aggressive skillfully, very skillful.
You know what?
He's more willing to attack now and throw combinations and get out than he was. Before, he would try to lure you in. He would throw his setup shots and get out. He would try to dart and play his outside game. Now he's more willing to step to you, throw his combinations, stepping to you, and to the body, and he'll roll out, catch his angles, and try to catch you again. He never was a bad defensive fighter either.
No, he just didn't move his head. This Lucian Bute, is funny. Obviously he could get caught and knocked out, but this guy doesn't get run out the ring the way he got run out the ring in Nottingham. This guy's just a little too smart, too crafty, a little too much resolve. He just wouldn't get run out of the ring by Carl Froch at this point. He's just a different, smarter fighter. And it's funny because he's diminished physically. So it just shows you, boxing is so much mental, because he would know how to go ahead and, develop and kind of manipulate his way around and fumble and fuddle his way around a situation like what happened in Nottingham before against Carl Froch. When he looked like a deer in headlights. I mean, Carl Froch came at him. He hit Carl Froch with a hell of a punch. Carl Froch walked through it and hit him back. And you could see he was just like, I don't know what to do next. Whereas now he wouldn't do that. He wouldn't know what to do next, So, and I think that's one thing that makes Bernard Hopkins so great, right? Because he's definitely diminished physically. And whether he wins tonight or not, the fact that he's probably going in as a favorite against a 27-year-old puncher who just came off the biggest win of his career, that just goes to tell you something about Bernard Hopkins in the science of boxing when applied properly.
And he's not
especially when
taller.
He's just a month short of his 52nd birthday.
Exactly.
Yeah. And Joe Smith knocked out a taller, younger, probably stronger, and faster light heavyweight than Bernard Hopkins.
And what the funny thing is? But Bernard Hopkins doesn't beat Fonseca. not right now.
He wouldn't catch him. It's Fonseca decides. It depends on Fonseca decides to fight. But I don't think.
Joe Smith is a big, strong guy, and Fonseca was so overconfident. And I'm not taking away from Joe Smith's, knockout, because he timed the shot perfectly. But Fonseca was just throwing with his hands down. But the Fonseca, Fonseca, who's dialed in, is just way too busy for a B, too big and too busy at this point for a B-hop. That's it. And so it's just funny how styles make fights. Bernard Hopkins, he has to watch out for Joe Smith's power. He has heavy hands. But from if Bernard Hopkins is, it's been 2 years, man, but if he has anything left, he outboxes this kid.
I saw the weigh-in pictures, and Joe Smith looks really bigger than Bernard.
He's
a big kid. He looks a little taller, and he definitely looks thicker. I mean, just density-wise, it's from chest to back. Oh man, that's the arms. Joe's a bigger kid than Bernard.
I think it may only be a 10-round fight too. I don't think it's a 12-round fight. I think it's a 10-round fight. I could see Bernard edging at 6'4". Just enough to not get caught and touching him here and there and mucking it up. But I don't know, man. Joe Smith, Bernard didn't win a round really against Sergey. You know what I mean? So, he might not win a round against Joe Smith. You just don't know.
I don't want to see how tough Bernard is again. I know.
Take shots. Yeah, I don't need to see him take shots. But, the fact of the matter is somebody.
Hello?
Yeah, he can fade in.
What I mean? Like, nobody's being like, oh, my God, he can't beat Joe Smith. They're like, well, he should beat this kid. It's like, well, he's 52. How should he beat this kid, So, at that point, he literally has accomplished. He's literally silenced his critics. You know what I mean? He's literally accomplished everything he's accomplished. Where there is nothing. I mean, if anyone has nothing left to prove, it's Bernard Hopkins. When he literally said, "You know what? Nobody questions me anymore. No one doubts me anymore. So there's no reason to go on. Nothing to prove." So he can really go out there and get smashed in one round, and they'd be like, "Well, you know what? He just took one fight too many." You know,
he's
52.
But what do you say? He's 52. What do you expect?
Yeah.
I mean, that's you're going to get that after that. It's not like people are going to say, "Oh, well, you know." The most criticism is say, "Well, damn, man, you shouldn't have did it. You know, you're 52."
Well, you know what they're going to say? They would say, "Well, he's 52, and he took on a top 10 light heavyweight at 27 years old, coming off the biggest win of his career." You know what I mean? Like, literally, Joe Smith could be that guy who's coming into his own, and that win over Fonfara could be the thing that signifies really big things to come. We don't know the ceiling this kid has, because most people hadn't seen this kid until Fonfara. So you really don't know the ceiling. This kid could be one of the great light heavyweights over the next few years, right? So you don't know. But what Bernard did is, even in his last fight at 52 years old, he's taking on a top guy. You know, not the top guy, but he's taking on a legitimate top 10 guy.
Yeah, and Bernard's never been one to shy from a challenge. I wonder what this kind of sparring Smith's getting for this. I mean, getting sparring partners that sort of simulate anything what Bernard does is kind of hard.
Well, you know what he probably has? He probably has a tall guy with a big head to prepare for a headbutt, and at the same time, he's got a little person. Yeah, he's got a little person, actually, just with a football helmet on, just running towards his groin. Because, that, you know, with Bernard, is heading nuts. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I mean, you fight it. He's fighting a big, strapping young lad. Oh, he's going to get hit in his head nuts all night long. He's going to get hit with forehead, and then he's going to get hit in his nuts all night long. All night long. That's why he needs to go ahead and make it a short night.
Try to.
Well, guys, we're up against the clock here again. And, again, it's been a fantastic year. We're going to be off the next 2 weeks. But I want to thank you both for a tremendous job again this year. As every year, I wish you and your families both a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and happy health to Mr. Mel as he gets back on his feet. So we appreciate each and every week that you're on, and each and every day that we've known you. You've always been tremendous people to be with and have fun with. And, Z, I got to tell you, I had a can of jambalaya, Campbell's Soup jambalaya today. It's nothing like yours and your mom's. Never will be. I have so many good memories, and my kids have so many good memories of being, oh, God, I forgot to call. Well, before we shut this thing down, I'll catch hell if I don't do this one. Have so many good memories of you guys and the Christmas Eves we'd spend together and the fun we'd have at school.
I had my first taste of champagne in your garage on New Year's Day with Bobby and Frankie. My very first taste of champagne. I'll never forget it. In your garage. And what was it? It wasn't Hollyoaks. You were off Abington Road, maybe?
Yeah, up in Dartmouth Woods. Yeah.
Dartmouth Woods, yep. In the garage, I never forget it. I also remember watching the Chicago Bears-New England Patriots Super Bowl where they killed the Patriots with that big man bear. 85, the 85 Bears. I watched that Super Bowl. We watched that Super Bowl over your house, if I remember correctly.
Yeah,
so,
yep.
It's funny.
Yep. Yep. I'm going to call Casey on the line here. I forgot to do that earlier. We'll get her on and she can,
hello?
She can reminisce with you. Hey, you ready to go?
Hey, yeah.
We got all the guys on the radio here. We just wished them a very Merry Christmas. We were talking about some times at the house up in Abington, and they tell me that you fed them some of my champagne when I wasn't looking.
That's when I first had champagne.
All I did was I helped Frank
in the garage.
No, I helped Frankie. I helped Frankie shift the bowl from the spike to the non-spike punch. That's it. I will admit that.
And now that we're admitting, is anybody going to admit who pulled the fire alarm?
I told you, I will tell you till it's, I never forget who pulled the fire alarm. It was Jimmy Piovoso. I distinctly remember how everything happened. It all started with Luis Cabrera. Of course, it would start with him. He walks up to it and pretends like he's going to push it and moves away over it. And then Bobby goes and starts messing around with it, but he doesn't push it. I'm just looking and laughing. That's me. I just like to laugh. And then, so everybody just kind of playing around like they're going to push it. And, then we just, time just kind of stopped. We were all just kind of looking at each other. And Piovoso just pushes it. And I just remember we just took off. We ran up the hill. We all jumped in the cots like we were sleeping. And, it was Brother Bill. He didn't even go down to where the fire was. He just went straight to us. He just came straight to us, turned the light on, and was just like, guys, I know you're not sleeping. I know it was you. And I was like, oh, man, it wasn't me. But we never said who pushed it because, we didn't want to rat anybody out. But it was, I never forget, it was Jimmy Piovoso.
And there's another one, another memory, vivid memory just came to my to me about Frankie and Ty taking a ride to Philadelphia with a Marine.
Oh, and
Ty
my
coming
God,
home.
Yeah.
Ah.
God,
and Frankie
yes,
didn't.
Yes.
Frankie.
I remember that. I was with Frankie the night. Yeah, we stayed the night in the Days Inn. I remember that. Oh, God, the breakfast was so good. That's when Frankie enlisted. We were together. But what happened was I forgot my eyeglasses. I think that's when Frankie went in. Yeah, I forgot my eyeglasses. And so I went to go take the eye test, and they were like, wait a minute, do you wear glasses? And I was like, yeah. They were like, where are they at? I'm like, near my school locker. So my recruiter came and got me, brings me home. The next week, he's like, hey, you want to go up there and do it? I was like, nah, I'm done. I think I'm just going to college. That was it. It was literally it. But, yeah, Frankie and I stayed the night in the hotel. That's right. That was like one of the best times I had. Hey, Zito, you know what? I met the, remember that group, Zito, the Force MDs?
Yeah.
Like, Tears, that song. I met those guys that night. I never forget that. Yeah. Oh, my God. The breakfast was so good. They gave you all the bacon you could ask for.
Oh, wow. Okay, so I know you got a special thing you wanted to do, so...
Yeah, I just wanted to talk to everybody again about and I appreciate you guys letting me talk to you guys about it, but I guess St. Peter's Cathedral had done, probably a couple months ago, they had started a fundraising drive, and you could purchase nameplates to be put either on the classroom door or on bookshelves or chairs in the library, tables in the library, whatever. They come in different sizes, and they're at different prices per size of nameplate. So I had ordered a couple, one in memory of Bobby and one just, that I had put over one of the classroom doors, telling the kids that, no limits to your dreams, that sort of thing. And I reached out to them because there was an alumni gathering in October and obviously couldn't be up there for it. And I asked them if they could send me some pictures of the plates that were up because I wanted to show them to my parents. And the lady was really nice, took a bunch of pictures, and then she sent them to me, and I told her that the school looks exactly the same as when we were little. Even the gymnasium downstairs where we used to have our PE and everything, and I told her that we had some of the best memories there and still have a lot of great friendships from then. And I told her that we were there when they were threatening to shut down the school and that our parents had gotten together and band together to kind of make sure the school stayed open. And she said, well, unfortunately, that's why we're doing this drive, because they're in a similar situation now where they're really being forced to either fundraise or shut their doors. So I told them I would try and help to get the word out. So if anyone's interested in donating to their fund or, getting a nameplate, they can go to either their Facebook page for St. Peter's Cathedral School or to their website. And the information's on there, the link to the company that's organizing all of it. So it's just, I told them I was sad to hear that they were in that spot again. But it's really neat. The pictures, you go on their Facebook page, and the pictures look just like all of us when we were in school there. Uniforms are the same. Everything's the same. Classrooms look identical. So But I wanted to get the word out there if anyone's interested. So yep. I'm helping out.
And I just happened to think of another thing. We were at when the Rosetta fell out of the ceiling of the church. And remember, we had used to have mass in the gymnasium, and it was a hot day. The windows were wide open, and you know, everybody's sweating. And of course, a fly comes around, and Joe McMahon. He swatted the fly, and then you take a look at his face, and he realized when he killed the fly, it went into the chalice. Because it was a consecrated wine at that time.
Oh,
everybody just looked. They had to look at the floor. They couldn't look at him. They couldn't look anywhere. He was broken half laughing.
Jesus.
We did have some great times together.
Yes, we really did.
And the basketball team, the time that you fought so valiantly to score at Holy Cross.
And the time you got locked out of the gym, you guys got chased out of the gym at the boys club. Remember that? And you got locked out of the gym. They said, because my dad somehow got the ref the game, and they said he was cheating. So,
those were the times, I tell you. Maybe the man I am today.
Well, I told her, I said, I have a lot of really, some of my best friendships are still from that school. You know, it's just amazing, the friendships we've
forged.
That
is true.
There,
that is very true.
Well,
I hope you guys are all doing well and have great plans for the holidays.
Well. And enjoy your holidays. And you've got some fine young lads, ma'am.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
I got great support helping me raise them. So great parents helping me raise them, too. So, but I appreciate that.
All right. Well, we're right at the end of our showcase. And,
all right. Well, I'll let you guys go and have great holidays. Okay?
You too. Enjoy
it.
Good talking to you.
Thanks. I enjoyed talking to you, too. Bye, guys.
So, guys, again, thank you very much for a great year. I look forward to another year. We have a couple really big guys coming on with us in January, so I'm going to hold that till January. But we do have the number one contender right now, and we have, again, we'll have Edner on. Dan Birmingham has some announcements to make. And Frankie Filippone will be on with us also. So that's what we're looking forward to in January. So, again, thank you. I wish both of you a very Merry Christmas. Z, I hope you your health stays good for the rest of this year and next year. And Ty, I hope your business takes off because you certainly deserve it.
Thank you, sir.
And I guess, Ty, you want to lead us out?
Hey, you know, it's been a great year. We've had a lot of fun, and we've all been blessed and made to be well. We look for the same thing in 2017 and, you know, just more prosperity. Bob is our co-pilot. We'll see you guys next year.
Yep. Z?
Oh, man. Well, it's been a wonderful year, and I can't wait till next year to do it all over again. I want to thank my Fighting Words family and give them all my appreciation and love. I want to thank the Carroll family. These shows are definitely in memory of Bob, and if anyone wants to hear any Fighting Words, please do call. Have a happy and safe holidays and wise new year. Butch?
Great. Ladies and gentlemen, these programs are brought to you each and every night of the week in grateful appreciation to the men and women of the United States Armed Forces. Men and women, police and fire services. When you're out there and you see somebody in uniform, please, they're under fire, whether they're at home or away. They're under fire every day. Please just let them know you know they're there. A handshake, a smile, a wink, or the best thing you can say to any of them is, be safe, my brother or my sister. These programs are also dedicated to those who've lost their lives in the line of duty. Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll, Patrolman David Curtis, Patrolman Jeffrey Colcap, Sergeant Thomas Batinger, Patrolman Jeffrey Yazowitz, Patrolman David Crawford, Detective Randy Bell, Detective Ricky Childers, San Diego Officer Mike Hendler, Lieutenant Mike Zerba, Newcastle County Police, Patrolman Arnolfo Crispin, Lakeland PD, Patrol Deputy Barbara Pell, Broward County Sheriff's Office, Chief Al Hogle, Longboat Key Police Department, Chief Jimmy Ford, Wilmington Fire Department, Highway Patrolman Alonzo Moses, Philadelphia Highway Patrol, Highway Patrolman Brian Lazaro, Philadelphia Highway Patrol, Highway Patrolman Brian Murphy, Plymouth Township PA Highway Patrol, Lieutenant Bob Neary, Philadelphia Fire Department, Deputy Chief Mike Godwin, Philadelphia Fire Department, MIT Officer Sean Collier, Sergeant Mike Wilson, Charlotte County Sheriff's Office, Deputy Jonathan Scott Pine, Orange County Sheriff's Office, Patrolman Robert Germain, Windermere, Florida Police Department, Trooper Chelsea Richards, Florida Highway Patrol, Lieutenant Joyce Craig Lewis, Philadelphia Fire Department, Patrolman Charlie Condit, Tarpon Springs Police Department, Sergeant Robert Wilson, Philadelphia Police Department, Louisiana Trooper Stephen Vincent, Harris County Deputy Darrell Goforth, Prince William County Deputy Ashley Gidden, Eustis, Texas Police Patrol Officer David Hofer, Hillsborough County Deputy Sheriff Charlie Kotloff, Captain Christopher Leek, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Jerry Ficus, Wilmington Fire Department, Sergeant Paulo Salto, New York Police Department, FDLE Inspector Vinny Galaccio, and Lieutenant Ardith Hope, Wilmington Fire Department. My brothers and sisters, although you may be 10-7 at this point in time, at some time we'll be 10-10 at the table of the Lord. Until that time, may the rose rise up to meet you. May the winds be always at your back. May the rains fall softly on your fields and the sun shine lightly on your face. Until we meet again, may the good Lord keep you and your families always in the hollow of his hands. Good night. God bless. Dispatch 1999. County dispatch to 1999. County dispatch to 1999. All units be advised, 1999 has responded to his last emergency. May God rest his soul.